I don't know, Derek. I'm planning on having all the members of Mere Fidelity give a eulogy at my funeral. Just letting you know right now. So,
let's just read long passages of Bob Inc. on death and glory.
You are listening to another episode of Mere Fidelity. My name is Matthew Lee Anderson. I am your host for the show. We are back after our fall break, and I'm looking forward to great things for the rest of the season. It's hard to believe that fall is here, but so it is. We've had rain and cool weather in Texas at last, which you love to see it. Thanks to our friends at Lexham Press for sponsoring this episode of Mere Fidelity. The Lexham Press Book of the Month is actually a whole series of books. There are lots of books of the month. We're stacking them all into October. The Lexham Ministry Guides, edited by our friend Harold Sink... I can never say Harold's name. Dr. Harold Sinkbeil. Wonderful books, pastoral leadership, stewardship. They're offering just a treasure trove of wisdom and experience for the church. Harold has done, and Lexham have done, just a terrific job of bringing forth resources that are really theologically robust, but extremely pastorally sensitive. This is the key thing, and just very wise. I'm really struck in reading these series how much wisdom they have, a kind of wisdom that is not on offer in many places these days because it's theologically saturated. So we love these books. Thanks to Lexham Press for sponsoring the show. You can find the details of that at lexhampress.com/mere fidelity. You can get any one of the books for 40% off, or all three if you want to be adventurous. Thanks also to the Merry Band of Mere Fidelity supporters for supporting the show. If you want to join them, merefidelity.com is where to do that. All right, speaking of Lexham Press Ministry Guides, we are delighted to have Dr. Timothy Perry on the show today with us. He's the Dean of Providence University Theological Seminary in Winnipeg, Canada, and a professor of theology at the same school. He is an author of many books, including Mary for Evangelicals. Most recently, though, he is the author of Funerals, which is one of the Lexham Press Ministry Guides, which you can get a discount on at lexhampress.com/mere fidelity. Dr. Perry, thanks for joining the show. We are so excited to have you.
Thank you, Matthew. I'm glad to be with you.
So I'm going to start with something that's totally unrelated to anything, but Winnipeg, Canada, as longtime listeners of the show will know, I am myself Canadian, so I have dual loyalty. So are you a child of the empire? Are we so blessed to have another Canadian at last on the show?
I was born in Ottawa and raised on the Quebec side of the Ottawa River. So I'm a very rare bird. I'm an Anglo-Québécois.
Okay. That is rare. Well, I'm glad to have another Canadian at least. I was actually born not far from Winnipeg in a tiny town with the same name as the dwarf from Lord of the Rings.
Gimli. There you go.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, we are delighted. I've read your work on various themes. Derek has just shaken his head.
I we're talking about funerals, and I feel buried in all of this this Canadian, you know, trivia. And that's fine. It's okay. It's on subject in that regard.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit of a heavy subject, funerals, and so this is our only chance for lighthearted discussion. But I'm really excited to talk with you about this, Dr. Perry, because funerals are maybe perversely very near and dear to my heart. And so I'm excited to talk with you about your book, Theology of Death, How We Do Funerals Well. Would you just lay out for us, to get us started, what's the problem with funerals these days? Like, why is it that we have shifted from, why is funerals even an uncomfortable word for us to say?
Well, I guess the first thing I want to do is define who we and us are. So I'm going to assume we're talking about believers rather than the larger North American culture. I mean, they have their own issues with funerals too. But the problem has to do with a loss of cohesion around the significance of the rites of passage. And you know, whatever you think about the days of Christendom, I'll tip my hand here. I don't think they were nearly as bad as some theologians seem to think they were, but we can talk about that maybe in a future podcast. One of the nice things it did was it provided a kind of a substructure around the rites of passage so that everybody knew what everything meant and everybody had a role to play in everything. Whether we were talking about, you know, baptism or child dedication, confirmation or kind of an adulthood ceremonies, marriage, and then funerals. At one point, and you know, I'm old enough, I can kind of just barely remember it. At one point, everybody knew what had to be done. Now, in the rise of kind of the self as consumer, and you get to, you know, design everything, any notion of being initiated into something larger than yourself and your purchasing power is increasingly lost. And it's lost in the church too, such that funerals and weddings, weddings are probably worse, but we're talking about funerals today. Funerals are whatever the family wants them to be. And that's not, it seems to me, a Christian understanding of the death of a believer. And so that's I think why we need this book, is to kind of rescue people out of the sensibility that when a loved one dies, they've got to design it. I'm not sure they do. The church has something to say. It has the word of God to proclaim, and some of those things aren't optional, because death in general is bigger than the death of any one person, and our union with Christ in death is, you know, pretty important and needs to be talked about and expounded.
Yeah, that's helpful. So, I mean, you use the language of rites of passage, which is a lovely phrase, but even also, like, it feels a little archaic.
Oh, it is, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. It's a foreign concept to have rites of passage more broadly. I think when it comes to funerals, you talk about it being the family's responsibility. So I'll just lay my cards on the table. I'll get the personal stuff out there, because it's going to stand in the background of everything that I would talk about. I think longtime listeners of the show would possibly remember that I lost my sister-in-law in 2018 to a pretty significant bout of cancer, which she had dealt with for 5 years. And you know, the final few months of her life were spent in fairly steady decline, but she had a lot of agency. And one of the main questions that came up was, to what extent should she herself have agency over the contents of her funeral? Because, you know, it's a sort of, it's a weird thing to be able to approach your own death and to have some sort of say about what happens after you're gone. And one of the things that we sort of ended up talking about or ended up discovering was she actually really loved the thought of participating in the planning of her funeral, because it felt like her last project. It was sort of for the last thing that she could do in this world. It was her last gift. So she actually really invested in it, got into it. I'm curious, obviously that's one case. Not everyone gets to have some sort of say over their own funerals. But in terms of thinking about this sort of consumerization, the customization of these rites of passages, where everyone gets to decide what they want them to be, to what extent can that be rehabilitated or saved? How much of it is a sort of gift of the person to, could it be a gift of the person to the community that they leave behind?
Yeah, certainly it could. And, you know, in the second part of the book, I talk a fair bit about the decisions that family members will have to make and, you know, the last wishes of their loved one, whether they have things fairly planned out or not. So certainly they're involved, and I can't foresee a situation in which, you know, any pastor worth their salt would say, you know, just leave it with me. Thank you very much. Because this is too important to entrust to you. I think that's not at all what I meant. Certainly, you know, if the dying person has a say in their own funeral planning, I think that's great. But it is an opportunity for pastors to engage in some pretty serious catechesis about what it means for a believer to die, and to do the funeral planning in the light of that reality, so that it's not just personal preference, you know, and that can extend down into the details, like what's said at the eulogy, what songs are chosen. You know, I talked a fair bit about hymns and eulogies, actually, and those things are kind of important. And there are some Christian-ish songs, and maybe even some hymns that may be well loved, but should not be sung at a funeral. And maybe they can be sung at a reception afterwards. But there are some weighty things happening in a funeral that are greater than the last wishes of the person, and those things need to be given their proper consideration. And I'm afraid we're losing purchase on that, and the we there being, you know, believers. My last 5 years before I came back to Providence, I was living in my hometown, and we moved there because my dad was dying with colon cancer. And while we were there caring for him, of course, death was at the forefront of my own imagination, and I was working in a funeral home. So I got a chance to kind of see what was going on directly. A couple of times I was having conversations with my boss, the funeral director in my small town, who was, you know, not a terribly strong believer, but even he would say, you know, they just don't get it. They think they get to make it up as they go along. And there's more to it than that. And he's absolutely right. And it's as I'm wanting in the book to recover a sense of what that there's more to it really is.
Yeah. The only funeral I've ever preached so far is my grandmother's, maybe 7 or 8 years. I'm blanking on the exact date, but it was years before my ordination, early on in ministry and that kind of thing. And her later years was a little bit more disconnected from parish and that kind of thing. And I just remember that sense of the family having to do a bunch of stuff and like, what do we do next? What's this? And the aid that a seasoned pastor who knew what they were about would have been to the family at that moment. It's a deep resource. I mean, I've seen a couple of funerals go the dignity of what is being performed at that moment, what is being passed through by the family and the remembrance involved. The need for a guide is real, and actually is a huge blessing if somebody knows what they're doing well in those times. So yeah, I absolutely see that. The burden of freedom there is not a good one. Consumer choice hurts more than helps there.
Yeah, I think that the problem is not freedom per se. The problem is too much, right? And I hope that, you know, readers get a sense in part two that I'm not insisting on the scripting of everything, but rather trying to sketch out pastoral responsibilities to the dying, to their loved ones, and more broadly to their parish before we get to that point, in terms of it's part of their formation as disciples to begin to think about what it means for a Christian to die, so that when the time comes, they've already got, you know, the necessary tools to exercise their proper freedom in putting a service together.
So can I ask about that? You say what it means for a Christian to die. Can you fill that out a little bit? What you've got several chapters, and there's a couple that I was, there was one specifically that I was surprised to see in there, right? Like you've got a chapter on the doctrine of hell, which on a, for a book on funerals is perhaps a little bit of a surprise, just given the possible disconnect between the sort of, I don't know, comforting nature of a Christian doctrine of last things, but hell and judgment are questions that people face when they're burying those who are outside of grace, right? Like these are hard issues. So I'm interested, like as you talk about, you said several times now, what it means for a believer to die. How should Christians think theologically about death and what it does mean for the Christian to die?
Maybe the easiest way toward an answer is to kind of contrast Christian thinking about death with various elements I see in popular culture. Popular culture is not very good at talking about death at all, first of all. So just saying from the pulpit, you know, folks, today we're going to talk about the psalmist's words, you know, being about the grave being cut off from the presence of God. That's automatically going to take your parishioners to a place that they have not been Monday through Saturday. And they should be, because it's part of God's word. So, we're, you know, culturally, we're not very well equipped to have any kind of conversation about death, let alone a specifically Christian one. So that, you know, that might be a place to start. In my work with people at a funeral home, I was struck by, you know, even amongst pretty devout families, how heaven had become not so much union with God and a reunion in light of that greater union, a reunion with loved ones, that is, but it had just become kind of an extended family reunion. You know, death was kind of an inconvenient interruption in an otherwise happy life, particularly if the person was older and it was a believer of long standing. Death was just kind of a skip in the record, and now the tune can continue. And that simply doesn't do justice to the scriptures. Christians need to hear that death is the end. It's in some way the severing of all of our loving relationships. And as a result, it is the last enemy. It's the last enemy before which we will all fail and fall, unless, you know, and I quote Luther in the book, unless the right man is on our side, the man of God's own choosing. And it's him that transforms death into a greater union with God, an entry into life in the fullest. Christian thinking about death, I think, needs to actually talk about death and to bring Jesus back into the center of that conversation. You know, what does it mean to be baptized into Christ's death? Romans 6. We want to skip straight to Paul's words I think it's Philippians, you know, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. And that's right, and that's true, and that's good, but there's a lot of the Bible to go through before we can get there. And reinvigorating Christian biblical vocabulary, Christian imaginations with the imagery of the Bible with respect to death, I think, is the place to start.
It's interesting to think about death as enemy. I mean, when Paul speaks in 1 Corinthians 15 of those who have died, while he describes death as the last enemy, he only speaks of those who have died as those who have slept. You know, he's only talking about those who have died in Christ. And so it's interesting the way in which his rhetoric seems to shift based on who he's talking about or which phenomenon he's talking about. So the death as enemy is there, it's real, but those who have actually sort of defeated it are effectively asleep. And so the metaphors get mixed. But I'd be curious to hear you reflect on, you've got some discussion early on in the book about just modern theology. And you've done a lot of work in modern theology. And it seems to me that one of the things that Bart and those who follow after him, Derek's given me a look, because we have this discussion, we have this sort of long-running discussion about the value or lack thereof of Karl Barth. And here's one thing that I'm going to say that's
he's valuable in places.
Yeah. But here's one thing that I'm going to say that I think is critical of Barth.
This area though.
It seems to be the case that for Barth and for others within the modern theological world, the notion of death as enemy gets neutered in such a way that it's death becomes a sort of built-in feature of the structure of creation, that it's just the end of the time, the allotted time that humanity has, and that the disclosure of the defeat of death by Christ gets read back into the structure of creation proper. And that really does something for, I think, how we think about death more broadly. That to me is not necessarily helpful or constructive. It lacks the sharp edges that I think you are pointing to with sort of thoughts about death as enemy, death, you know, hell, judgment, these things that are uncomfortable. I just love to hear you reflect on that. Like, death within the modern sort of theological framework and sort of the modern experience, why is it that the language of enemy, judgment, et cetera, is so uncomfortable for us?
Oh, gosh. I wonder if it is, broadly speaking, because death is the one great reminder that we're not as in charge as we think we are. And I have been particularly thinking that thought over the last 2 years, where, and I'm speaking as, I got to put the disclaimer out, I'm speaking as a gratefully doubly vaccinated person. Okay. I don't know if that loses you listeners or not, but that's just where I'm coming from. Where it looks to me like, as I follow the COVID numbers in North America, the government rhetoric and the medical professional rhetoric is completely disproportionate to the reality on the ground. And I wonder if that is because they have in front of them a pretty stark reminder that they're not as in charge as they think they are, and so they're going to try to control this as strictly as they can. And the harder they try, to my ears anyway, the more ridiculous they sound. And that's not to say COVID isn't real and it's all a hoax and all that stuff. It is real. And for some people, it is deadly. And for other people, there are long-term consequences. And some people get over it. And I don't understand the ins and outs of it. I am glad there are people who do. And I've done my research as best I can. And I've come to the conclusion that for me, in a fairly high risk group, the risks of being vaccinated are outweighed by the risks of not being vaccinated. So I went ahead with that. I'm not talking about that. It's the rhetoric in which the whole package comes,
right,
that suggests to me that, you know, we thought with the advances of medicine and palliative care and even medically assisted dying, which is just a ridiculous term, but it's the one we've been given, that death is something we could manage. And along comes COVID, and it's maybe one of, you know, God's left-handed blessings to say to us as a culture, no, you can't. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. So that might be a place to start anyway.
So I have the delight and joy of working with college students on campus at a major university. And I thought it would be a great idea to open up our time back on campus by looking at Ecclesiastes and reminding them every week they're going to die. And so
swinging for the fences. Good for you.
Heck yeah. It's been wonderful. But like every week I tell me, hey, just a reminder, you're going to die. And that impacts everything you're doing right now. 18 or 19 year old young man or woman. And, but one of the things we're going over with them is the fact that, you know, death presents itself as a limit in Ecclesiastes to a lot of our kind of Promethean attempts to gain, under the sun. Like all the toil with which you toil under the sun, what does a man gain? And, you know, depending on how you look at what gain means, death is a limit on that. You know, whether it's the consumption of great goods, cultural, you know, cultural works, wisdom itself, right? The wise man and the fool both die. And that's a great evil. And it's one that you don't control. And that's what, you know, I was kind of trying to pound into their heads last week with everything. There's a season and it's all under heaven. It's all from God's hand. And that death as that final thing that you cannot manage, you cannot manipulate, you cannot, which means that you actually can't set the terms on how your story ends. That has been a big theme that I think has just been eye-opening for these students. And I think there's a great comfort in that, and, you know, kind of living down to reality. I'm curious, I didn't get to this part, eulogies and the appropriate measure for a pastor who's preaching a sermon or preaching a funeral to reflect on someone's accomplishments within the funeral in relation. So because there's a sense in which, like, you're talking about what they have wrought, and you're also talking about what God has wrought in their lives, and that's a real mixed bag. So with death as sort of a limit and death bringing into light judgment, not just judgment before the seat of God, but judgment on, like, I don't know, their works before men and, you know, in humanity, talk about how a pastor should, like, start thinking through dealing with the judgment on a person's life, finished or unfinished, in a sense, as it is.
Gosh, that's a good question. The first thing I want to do is draw a pretty sharp distinction between a funeral sermon and a eulogy. Mm-hmm. I think they're two different things. And a wise pastor, even if they're doing both, and I'm not sure that's a good idea, but whatever. Even if they're doing both, they should be two different moments in the service. The sermon really is the opening up of the scriptures such that they can absorb the world of the people sitting in the pews. So I think that they're two different things. You know, and in the book, I talk pretty frankly about eulogies are risky because ideally someone other than the pastor should be giving the eulogy, and that means the pastor is giving up control. And that's a problem. You know, if you've been in ministry more than 5 minutes, you can point to an awkward story that begins with someone saying, "I'm sorry, Father, but," you know, and I've had a few of those. Thankfully, none nearly as embarrassing as others of my colleagues. Nevertheless, I do think there is a place in a Christian funeral for a eulogy, much like, Matthew, you might like this, much like the placing of Prince Philip's medals in his service. You know, his service was very plain. There was no homily. There was no eulogy. It was strictly the reading of scripture. But his eulogy was his service medals there. And I think that, you know, that was fitting and appropriate because it was a reminder that here was a real person with a real life lived before the face of God. And now he is being judged by that. In part by us, but more importantly by God. You know, the Philip who lived is now the Philip who is before God and God's righteous and gracious judgment. And I think the eulogy is an opportunity to remind us that the person we're burying was in fact a real flesh and blood person. That doesn't mean that it's an opportunity to lionize the dead and you know, try in some kind of crass way to sway the judgment of God one way or the other. But it is an opportunity to remind all of us that this was a real person and that where that person is now, we will one day be. And I think, you know, if a pastor has opportunity to kind of reflect with the person giving the eulogy beforehand to talk about those kinds of things and help them shape, well, first of all, choose the stories they want to tell and then shape them in the light of that. I think a eulogy can be very, very helpful. But boy, eulogies are risky. And, you know, the Catholic Church has basically said no eulogies, period. A short homily based on the readings, but no eulogies. And I think they've made that decision for prudential reasons. I'm not sure that. Well, and I don't agree with them all the way down, but I understand why they've come to that conclusion. I mean, you're giving away a key part of the service, and I mean, I talk about one circumstance that happened to me where nothing inappropriate was said, but the eulogy was literally 45 minutes long. It effectively derailed everything.
The 6 or 7 speaker eulogies at the funeral, where they're all heartfelt and even maybe beautiful in their own way, but that's the majority of the service. Is that?
I don't know, Derek. I'm planning on having all the members of Mere Fidelity give a eulogy at my funeral. Just letting you know right now. So,
let's just read long passages of Bob Inc. on death and glory.
And there are creative ways around that too. You know, we can suggest to people that maybe some memories can be shared at the wake before or at the reception after. We still have wakes up here. Do you have wakes down there?
Not unless you're Irish.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that is good though. Those sorts of times are necessary. I think the sharing absolutely necessary.
So let me ask this. There's a lot that we could talk about with respect to what makes a good funeral. I'm interested. I've got two very disparate questions I'd love to hear you think about in the time that we have remaining. One is just what makes a good burial. You know, insofar as funerals happen, there's a very prosaic, mundane dimension that has to go on within this whole process. There's a body, and somehow that body has to be disposed of. And I use disposed of, it's a terrible term, but I'm not sure what else to insert there, precisely because people do have a question between burial and cremation. So that's a very practical decision that a lot of people face. I'd love to hear you reflect on just theologically how people can think about that decision. And then obviously thinking about funerals, there's the supply side, there's the pastoral side, how pastors should sort of prepare their congregations, inform people, and use this as an opportunity for catechesis. I'd love to hear you reflect on some of the consumer side, if you will, to use, again, terrible imagery or language. Like, how should those who are parishioners be thinking about our own funerals here and now? What value is there in terms of thinking about funerals for our own sort of spiritual development?
Well, two very different questions. I mean, I don't like the word disposal either, but I'm not sure what other word to use. So we'll stick with it. And there is a very practical concern that needs to be addressed. You know, at bottom, the funeral is the ritualized movement of a body from one place to another. and to leave it there. You know, that's what it is. So it is about disposal in some sense. Cremation is a tough one, particularly in North America. In England, for example, where cremation has a longer history within Christian practice, it's kind of an accepted part of the Christian funeral, at least for many Christians over there. Whereas for here, cremation growth is largely a cost-saving device, and not a whole lot of theological thought has gone into it. You know, what are we saying when we burn a body as opposed to burying it? What are we saying when we scatter someone's ashes at the cottage as opposed to burying them in sanctified ground? Those are questions that I think a lot of North Americans haven't thought through. North American pastors haven't thought through. I don't have a theological objection to cremation, provided we're all clear on what we're saying and what we're not saying as believers in cremating. We're not saying, for example, that the body doesn't matter because the soul has gone to heaven and so we can just burn it up. The Christian hope is still the resurrection of the dead. And I think the best symbolic expression of that hope is the burial of a body. Even as I recognize all kinds of reasons why that traditional perspective cannot be accommodated. You know, we talked a bit about COVID already. We can talk about it again. COVID has given people some real practical challenges with respect to what to do with someone who's passed away. And cremation to me, if you're going to have to wait, as some of people I know have done, upwards of a calendar year for a burial, you have to do something with that body, you know. And so it would be a question of what we're saying and what we're not saying in terms of the depth grammar of cremation that I would want to explore with a family. But I wouldn't rule out cremation at the get-go. And I'm willing to entertain, I mean, I don't know where Derek is, but I know you're in Texas, Matthew. I'm willing to entertain that this might be in part because in Canada, we have to talk about storing bodies for the winter because the frost gets into the ground and you can't open up a grave. And yeah. So we're used to having those kinds of delays that you wouldn't have in Texas, for instance. And so maybe that makes me a bit more comfortable with that subject. I don't know. But certainly, in terms of symbolizing the hope of the resurrection, the burial of a body is I think the best expressor of it. And that's of course why Charlemagne outlawed cremation in France, you know, way back in the 8th century or 7th century, whenever it was. And why, you know, Christians have traditionally been averse to it, because it can signal that the body doesn't matter. And certainly in, the funerary rites of Eastern religions, that's exactly what it does mean. Right. It cannot, if we're going to do it in Christian circles, it cannot mean that.
It also seems like it cannot mean we're just going to save money. One of the things I really appreciated about your book was that you highlight the possibility of churches paying for burials for those who have died, because it seems like that is, you know, one point at which the body is the community's, not property, but the responsibility to dispose of. So,
yeah, no, if we're going to teach our people about honoring bodies and the importance of honoring bodies, then, you know, financially we have to put up. Because in Canada, again, a pretty plain Jane traditional funeral will cost you upwards of $6,000-$7,000. And it's really easy to spend 12 and you haven't gotten elaborate or fancy.
Right.
A lot of the families that I've ministered to in my parish experience don't have that kind of money lying around.
Right.
So if we're going to talk about the importance of bodies and the hope of the resurrection, there's some real practical implications about the pocketbook, the parish budget, in terms of helping people out. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Take up very briefly for us the other question that I'd asked, which is, you know, if someone has been listening to this conversation, thinking about death, thinking about funerals, and they're not a pastor, what sort of salience or value does reflecting on this particular moment after a person's life have for their own edification and preparation for it?
It's one of the deep truths of Christian faith that the future bleeds into the present and shapes it, seems to me. And thinking about our mortality is one of the ways to be proactive about that. If you're a believer in Jesus, your death is inevitable, but your death is an entry into a greater union with Christ. How does that impinge upon the way you live now? I get a kick out of watching Mother Angelica on YouTube. And one of her favorite sayings was, "The Lord doesn't matter how many letters you have after your name as long as you have ST before it." and I do think that contemplating the inevitability of our deaths and accordingly the time limit that we have to do with this life that God has given sharpens questions about what does it mean to be conformed to the image of Christ. That's not something that I can put off till I'm old, because I might not get old. You know? And so I think I'd start there. I mean, that sounds kind of grim. I don't mean it to.
Good,
but
good. We love grim. This is mere fidelity.
We're not going to shy away from that here.
We harsh mellows.
You're in the right sort of room for that. I think even while that's a hard word, it's the right word. The sharpening of time. I love the language that you used. It sharpens our focus. On the things that matter. And, you know, the recognition that we have limited amounts of time bleeds back into even conversations like this. We have a limited amount of time, and there's so much more that we could talk about, but unfortunately we just can't. So thank you, Dr. Perry, for coming on the show.
Thanks for coming.
Really honored to have you.
Well, I sure have enjoyed it, guys. It was nice to meet you.
So if you've been listening along, the book is Funerals, Lexham Press. You can get a 40% discount on it at lexhampress.com/mere fidelity. Again, our guest has been Dr. Timothy Perry. We have other conversations on similar subjects available at merefidelity.com. And we will, of course, be back in the weeks to come with other conversations about how to navigate the world around us and how to think about even the time that comes after us. We are going to do a plus one with Dr. Perry. There's one question that we have been saving for him. So we're going to do that. If you want to get that, the link to do so is in the show notes at merefidelity.com. As I say, we'll be back in the future with other conversations. Until then, though, this has been Mere Fidelity.